So welcome everyone to another episode of a podcast by the Young Professionals Association of ESOT, YPT. It's my pleasure to be hosting this podcast again, and I've got some great guests for you. So today we're going to be talking about a career in transplant nursing, and I've got some exciting and amazing guests to tell us about their careers and give us some tips and hints and talk about nursing and an important aspect of transplantation. So please do feel free to go back on our old podcast and have a listen to them. So without too much of a delay, I'm going to introduce our guests. First of all, we've got Professor Anna Forsberg, who's currently the chair of the Allied Health Professionals Subcommittee of ESOT. She's been a registered nurse since 1991 and really had a clinical career in Gothenburg in Sweden. She's been involved with organ donation and transplantation from a training and a research perspective for many decades now. She did a thesis in health-related quality of life and coping after liver transplantation at the University of Gothenburg in 2001, and has been actively involved in research since then. She was promoted to Professor of Nursing at the University of Gothenburg in 2011, but has been working at the Lund University as a clinical professor in the caring sciences in organ transplantation since 2013. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Forsberg.
Thank you.
So our next guest is Lisa Burnap, who's a transplant nurse specialist since 1985 and a consultant nurse in living donation at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital. She did this after completing her master's in medical law and ethics in 2002. So she's been involved in the live donor program, which is a very successful live donor program at Guy's Hospital since 1995, and has maintained a clinical attachment there since then. She's also had several roles in NHSP blood and transplant as a lead nurse for living donation and is currently an associate medical director for living donation. Most importantly, Lisa became the first non-medical surgical person to become president of the British Transplant Society, which she led through a very tumultuous and difficult time through the COVID pandemic between 2021 and 2023, which was an amazing feat. And so we're very honored to have you, Lisa, on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
And then finally, we've got Anna Brandmark, who's a registered nurse since 2011, again, from Gothenburg, Sweden. She is currently a transplant coordinator in living and visceral transplantation, involved in patient education for all solid organ transplants. She's particularly interested in young adult patients and pediatric transplants as well. She's done a master's in specialist nursing at Gothenburg University and is currently enrolled in a PhD looking at the art and science of adaptation after liver and visceral transplantation. Anna, thank you for joining us. And I should say Anna is also a member of the education committee of ESOT as well. Thanks, Anna, for joining us and helping us to put together this podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great. So we've got a lot to discuss, and I'm going to rely on the expertise, the transplant nursing expertise of my friends and colleagues here to deliver this podcast. So first of all, I'd like to talk about each of you and how you got into transplant nursing and what made you stay in transplant nursing, what inspired you. Perhaps if we start with Lisa.
Thank you. Well, actually, I was wedded to the idea of becoming a midwife until I worked as a student nurse on the transplant nephrology ward at Guy's Hospital during my training. And it was an interesting time, actually, because I said I'd like to work on this ward because everybody said it was a very challenging place to work, but that actually the experience was great. And I thought, well, I know nothing about kidneys, so that's what I'll do. And I got the placement there and then realized that actually this was a really, really special place to work. And for me, it was It was several things, but it was about that long-term relationship that you establish with patients who have a chronic condition. And at that time, the ward had everything from acute renal failure to transplantation. So you really saw the whole gamut of their experience. So it was something about that relationship and the fact that they actually knew a lot more about themselves than I did. And so I learned a huge amount from them, but also about the team spirit. I mean, there was a really It was a very, it felt like a very flat structure in many ways. Of course, you had your inspirational leaders, but you had your consultants, your trainees, your nurses, all working together very much as a team, each with their own area of expertise, each working to their strengths within an area where there was mutual respect. And that was really something very, well, something I hadn't really come across until that time in my training. I suppose a really key figure for me, and this is often the case, and we'll probably come on to this again later, was the ward sister, who's now an extremely good friend of mine, but she was absolutely inspirational. And the way she ran the ward, her whole ethos, her whole philosophy, the way she interacted with patients and with all of us, really made it a very special environment. And I thought, that's who I want to be when I grow up.
I mean, that's such a common story in the world of transplantation, isn't it? That sort of mutual respect and team spirit is, I think, somewhat unique to the specialty, where you do ward runs together with nephrologists, transplant coordinators, nurses, surgeons, sit in MDTs together, all for patient benefit, and you enjoy each other's company and enjoy each other's successes, as well as patient successes. That's really somewhat unique in the world of medicine, I think. And that in itself is inspiring and to stay in, isn't it?
I think so. And I think, as a student coming into that environment, it was very different from anything I'd experienced before, as I say. And, the fact that the consultants didn't want to start their ward round until the ward sister or whoever was in charge of the ward was available, I thought was very telling because very often medicine and nursing were very separate, but they were very much. It was very much a togetherness thing. And as I say, it involved the patients as well, because for me, I mean, they knew so much more about themselves than I did. I can remember, we used to put jugs of water around on the ends of bed tables. We did it without thinking on every ward, and we used to replace them. And that was I'm showing my age now, but this was what we did when I was nursing. And twice a week we'd ask for a midstream urine sample from the patients. And I can remember putting the midstream urine packs out very efficiently, and a dialysis patient just walked up to me in the morning and said, "What would you like me to do with this?" And of course, he was anuric, and I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that moment. And I mean, there were lots of things like that, lots of illustrations like that. I suppose that probably the real moment for me, in fact, was I'd completed my placement on that particular ward, and really knew that that was where I hoped to work when I qualified, and was fortunate enough to be appointed to a staff nurse position. And I remember it was almost within the first week of my appointment, there was a transplant happening, went down to theatre, and at that time there was a medical student assisting. I mean, you probably wouldn't see that so much now, but certainly not in the UK. And the medical student felt a bit woozy, and I remember the surgeon, and he was quite a character in himself. He looked around the theatre, and literally his eyes settled on me, and he said, "And what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm observing." And he said, "Not anymore, you're not." So I scrubbed, and I said, "Okay, but you have to point, and tell me where retractors are and things." And he did that, and really, I suppose a real moment for me, and I've described this before, is he'd done the anastomosis, and he put the kidney in my. He said, "Hold this virtually, put the kidney in my hand, and release the clamp, the vascular clamps," and this sort of stream of urine came out. And it was just a moment that I've never forgotten, and I never will forget. And I think you realize how you're really giving life in a way that is very special in transplantation. That was my transplant moment, I call it. But
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you touched on two really important things there. One is mentorship from the ward sister, and two is the involvement that that surgeon gave you, that experience that surgeon gave you to then inspire you to stay in that field. And we'll come back to that, those two concepts a little bit when we talk about recruitment, perhaps. So thank you, Lisa. So can I ask Professor Forsberg what got you into transplantation?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually apply for transplantation. I was more I was in general surgery, and I was assigned to job at the transplant unit because there was a shortage of nurses in 1994. I didn't know that much about it, but I went to it was the abdominal transplant program. So I worked with kidney, liver, and pancreas recipients. One day I went down to the ICU to bring back my first liver recipient, a woman, to the ward for post-transplant recovery. And I looked into her eyes and I was immediately hooked. The thing is that I got to know her and her family quite well, and I followed her and her family for 20 years. She had three sons, and she had always wished for a daughter with red hair. And since I have red hair, when I approached her in the ICU, she sort of believed that I was the daughter she never had. So they sort of theoretically adopted me into their family, and I followed her for 20 years. And then her life unfortunately ended due to post-transplant complications. So that's one of the reasons why I stayed. And I am very much dedicated to advocate for organ recipients because I believe that they are true heroes. I always felt very much humble and amazed by their struggle to survive before transplantation and to go through this rather complicated procedure, and then how they strive to find their new normality afterwards. I think they develop an impressive resilience while adapting to their new normality, and I think it's, you know, I've never stopped being amazed by that. And I also got the opportunity to pursue a research career in transplantation and to combine my clinical work with research. And that sort of, I think, has enabled me to be quite loyal to transplantation. Today, I was specialized originally in liver transplantation, and I did my thesis about health-related quality of life. And I wanted to understand if it was worth it to survive. Today, since 10 years, I'm with a thoracic transplant program in Lund, and I'm a clinical professor, so I can support evidence-based transplant care, and I can promote implementation of new knowledge into the clinical practice on a weekly basis. So that sort of keep up my motivation. Also, the work I do within ESOT also helps me to keep up the motivation.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that long-term follow-up of patients not only just the long-term, but the instant gratification and job satisfaction that you get after a transplantation is just amazing, isn't it? And that feeling never goes away, I think, no matter how long you've been in transplantation. And then having some interest outside transplantations, you know, not outside, but related to transplantation, whether it's research or education. As you said, you used an interesting word there, kept you loyal to the field. That's an interesting way of looking at it. And because I guess that adds another element to your work, doesn't it? And it, in fact, has a translational element to your work.
Yeah, and I think it's very much about commitment. And there is something with the area of transplantation that wants you to stay committed for a very long time. As Lisa mentioned, it's lifelong relationships with the patients, and it's sort of, you know, it's an area where things develop very fast, new technology, but also new medication and new challenges to the patients. And I think it sort of fosters the commitment, the lifelong commitment that keeps you motivated.
Thank you very much for that, Prof. So we'll move on to Anna Brandmark, who's after those two titans in transplant nursing, with one of our more recent entries into transplant nursing. What got you into transplant nursing?
For me, it was a complete coincidence in the beginning. I was in nursing school and I was looking for somewhere to work during the summers and weekends as a nurse's assistant, and I went on the website for the university hospital and I just sent in a form and got matched with the transplant units where I started working as a nurse's assistant. And Yeah, I just kept on there when I was when I graduated. It felt safe to continue at a place that I knew, and I knew my colleagues, and I knew that that it was a good sort of place for me to start. And the transplant ward in Gothenburg, I think, is quite unique because we care for all solid organ recipients. And so, as a new nurse, it was extremely rewarding to collaborate with all the different doctors, the lung doctors, the cardiologists, the surgeons. We had them all in the same ward. But then, to be honest, I wasn't very loyal because I actually quit. I felt the need to see something else after a few years, and I started working at a outpatient clinic for people suffering from chronic pain, which was also very rewarding. And when I later went back to the transplants outpatient clinic, I had a new perspective on chronic conditions and the situation that all of our patients are put in after transplantation. And so now I primarily work with the liver and visual recipients, and being in the outpatient clinic and also getting involved in research has absolutely made me more loyal. It's
That's
a great field for a nurse.
great, and that's really interesting that you went somewhere else and came back. And I think that different perspective has clearly made an impact on your career, hasn't it? And I suppose there'll be a lot of nurses, hopefully listening to this, who are not in the transplant field and thinking, well, what does my experience of oncology or whatever or something else have to do with transplant nursing? But it very much does, doesn't it? Because it's all related and it's all relevant for that transplant patient.
Absolutely.
So then the next question I wanted to ask is, why or do we have a problem in recruitment of transplant nurses? You've all given us numerous examples of why transplant nursing is amazing. Lisa, do we have a problem in the UK of recruitment into transplant nursing?
I think I'd go even slightly broader than that. I think we have a bit of a problem with recruitment into nursing, actually. And I think this is really what the pandemic has shown us is, or coming out of the pandemic, is that people are very committed, but they do want to have a job that they feel is very fulfilling, but they don't want that to fulfill every waking hour of their life. And I think the work-life balance issue is really, really important. So I think, and for me, I mean, for all of us around this table, we are committed to what we do because I was thinking as I was listening to Anna Fosberg, I was thinking, those things all ring true for me too. That it just offers something else. There's always something new. There was, I almost feel that my career happened to me rather than I went out to seek it because transplantation is one of those areas that I feel I've grown up with in many ways. And that is very special, but you have to be exposed to that in order to appreciate it. So I think it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. I think that student experience, that early experience of the specialty is really important, and I'm not sure we're very good at doing that across the board. I think we tend to channel nurse education in a slightly different way we wrap it differently, and people don't get that sort of exposure for long enough to appreciate whether it might be something they would really want to be invested in. And I think we do need to make it attractive. I think we do need to offer people the opportunity to work flexibly, to consider the impact of on call and so on, and how we manage that within our teams. And I think we need our inspirational leaders, and our role models, because they're really that was why I stayed, because I saw people who I thought that's actually what I would. That's the person I would like to be, or I would like to emulate that. And I think all those things are really important. So, do we have a problem? Of course, I think we do have a problem. I don't, but I think we have perhaps very similar problems across our NHS in the UK in terms of recruitment and making nursing roles attractive, and people wanting to stay in nursing for reasons other than, purely remuneration and so on.
Do you think, I mean, exposure is a real problem, isn't it? I mean, because Certainly in the UK, transplantation is siphoned to a few hospitals in the country, and even in the surgical specialties, if you don't happen to do a transplant job, you may end up doing one of the general surgical specialties. And that's certainly what happened to me. So I guess we got to find ways of exposing transplant professionals, allied health professionals, to the profession in some way, because that's the only time, that's the only way we're going to, grab them,
Yeah,
basically.
yes, and I think, I mean, when I look back now, the opportunities I had to attend meetings, study days, and so on were much greater. There was much more opportunity to do that, I think, when I was on my way up, if I can say that. Whereas now, I think, I know we'll come on and talk about it, but things like the European Society of Transplantation, the British Transplantation Society, where I've been much closer to that, actually getting those opportunities for nurses to be sponsored, to attend meetings, to have both time and money to do that, has become increasingly difficult. And certainly in the UK, I can't, I'm not sure about European perspective, but if you're a nurse prescriber, you may attract sponsorship. But if you're not, then you're reliant on your research fund or your nurse managers to say, yes, you can go. And of course, they're caught in a conundrum as well of financial constraints in a very financially constrained climate. So all of this plays into people having those opportunities. And even if people are encouraged to submit work to meetings, there's no guarantee that then they will be supported to actually go unless they pay for themselves or find it in their own time. And this is very variable. And because of that, actually, I don't think people have. I'm not saying this is a universal truth, but all in some places definitely don't always have those opportunities. And it's not just in for some organs in the transplanting centres. So, for example, if you look at kidney transplantation, the non-transplanting centres where the patient base is, where those nurses are working with patients who will ultimately have a transplant, but if they're not exposed to the transplant environment, how do they ever have those conversations or feel part of that conversation? So it's actually really quite complex. There is a dilution effect as well from transplant centres outwards, from the areas where they're referred from and to.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point actually, because we get referrals certainly in the kidney transplant world from peripheral units where there's clearly lots of renal dialysis nurses, but they never really get a chance to come and see a transplant operation or sit in an MDT, and those are feel like somewhat easy wins really in a way, and also the funding is a real issue actually. Professor Forsberg, what's the situation like in Sweden in terms of transplant nursing and recruitment?
Well, I think it's not a specific problem for transplant nursing. It's more like a general problem with Swedish healthcare. We have a huge nursing turnover, and I think one key reason is that the healthcare or the hospital care is organized in a way that doesn't make sense for nurses today. It's very much fragmented, lack of continuity. And nurses are very much educated into to work within caring relationships, and it makes it difficult for them to provide professional care. But in addition to what Lisa mentioned, because I agree with her in her analysis, but I also think actually, and I want to emphasize the importance of exposure and what we have done in Lund, this in the nursing program in Lund, we have this mandatory day in their third year where we talk about organ donation and organ transplantation for a whole day, and I lead and organize that day together with the transplant coordinator, and it's very much appreciated. The evaluations are great, and they feel very blessed to have that opportunity to really get an insight and understand what organ donation and organ transplantation is about. And there are very few universities in Sweden that provide such a day. So I think that's one thing we can do to attract specifically nurses into transplantation. But I also would like to link to what Lisa said and emphasize the importance of role models. I remember from when I was young and went to the nursing school, the importance of role models. And also that we emphasize the rewarding contribution that transplant nurses actually do. And also that we discuss and present the never-ending challenges involved in transplantation. And also that nurses are a part of that, are a part of the solution. That nurses are an important part of the transplant care team. That probably would also increase the motivation to apply for a position in transplant care and to stay there.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree with that. I think recognition and of role models is somewhat lacking, isn't it? And I think especially in the nursing world, I think having role models is so important in anyone's career, and mandatory training days and exposure days and taster days, as we call them in the UK, we need more of those for sure. One of the things that I get with when I try to talk about recruitment for transplant in general is work-life balance, and there's this ongoing somewhat of a myth, I think, that transplantation is so much more worse than any other speciality in terms of work-life balance. With people out there think we're, you know, up all night, every night, every day, we don't see our kids and family and so forth. What's work-life balance? Is work-life balance a real issue, Anna, in terms of your career so far? And what would you say to people who think that work-life balance is such a problem in transplant nursing?
Well, I think most nurses have the same experience in that we're constantly being asked to work extra shifts, and the stress of being there for the clinic, sort of. And I think that was one of the reasons why I left in the beginning, because I didn't feel like I got the flexibility back that I gave. And also I didn't get the involvement that I wanted in the organization and to be involved in improving the care, because when it comes down to it, you need to solve the issues like on the floor in the ward. Because I think that everyone agrees that all these things are great, you know, with the going on congresses and education, but it needs to be possible.
You need the support of your department to do that, really, isn't it? And expand on your career. Otherwise, it can be quite difficult. But when you do get that opportunity, it's a fantastic opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm curious to see, Anna and Lisa, you've been nursing for a lot longer than myself. Like, what's changed? What's different now from 20 years ago?
I remember when I started in the transplant unit in Gothenburg, and the head of the unit, he said that we never turn down an offer. We will never say no to an organ. And that was sort of our mission. And it didn't mean that we were on call 24/7. We had our shifts and then we were off. We had this sort of commitment, and it was the culture at the unit then that you never say no to an organ. And sometimes I remember when I worked weekends, from Friday to Monday, we could have two, sometimes three donors in 4 days. And everybody was committed, working hard. The surgeons were sleeping like 4 hours, and then they went up again doing their operations. We prepared patient after patient after patient. But we were not exhausted, because we had this drive that we never say no to an organ, and we are changing people's lives. My impression is sort of that might have changed 20 years later. I got the question a couple of years ago in Lund when I gave a lecture in the theater about one of the operating nurses asked me, "Do you never get bored talking about transplantation?" And I was like, "What? I don't understand what you're talking about. No, I never get bored." And she was like, "Okay, impressive." So, and I think sort of extra involvement is actually required if you are supposed to stay within transplantation for many, many years.
I would agree with Anna in many ways. I think things are different. I mean, teams were smaller. You were very close-knit. I mean, you had no choice but to work like, and everybody did. And I'm not sure, you know, I can remember at night when, you know, almost doctors were asleep at the desk because they were so tired. I'm not sure that was right either. So there is a balance between those two things. I think perhaps what has changed the most is everything else that nurses are expected to do around their clinical work. And I think that that is draining actually for people because, I mean, I always say I've had a blessed career because I just can't imagine doing anything I love more than what I'm doing. And I still say that now. And I, you know, fell into living donation as pretty much as I fell into kidneys. It was that kind of experience for me. But it was, and of course, it was saying it wasn't as simple as it was just sitting there waiting for it to happen. You know, it was offered, and I said, yes, okay, I'll try that. You know, I wanted to give things a go. I still think people have that deep down. I still think transplantation attracts a commonality of purpose. I mean, I think you don't go into transplantation because you want an easy life. You don't go into transplantation for that kind of experience. You go into it because you know there's something special about it. And if you look at a group of people working together in this specialty, they have got a particular sense of purpose and commonality. I remember a diabetologist, doesn't matter who it was, but a diabetologist came to one of our transplant meetings in the UK, and he said, our meetings aren't like this. And you know, you sort of feel proud to be part of something. And I suppose that's how I've always felt, proud to be part of something I believe in that is really good for patients. You know, there's nothing that sort of when all the management stuff was getting me down in the days when I did the management bit. And I'd go onto the ward and Dylan referred to it earlier, and you'd see that patient transplanted. You know, for me, it was they'd had a living kidney donor, the transplant the day before, and they were walking down the ward and their cheeks were pink and they had the catheter bag swinging. And you thought, actually, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. And it still does. So it's what we've talked about. It's really that being, you know, it's a bit like doing a master's or a PhD, isn't it? It's going to be tough, but if it's really enjoyable, then you get through the toughness because you want to. And it's the same sort of thing. You know, yes, of course, it's not for the faint-hearted, but equally, you know, there's a huge amount of enjoyment in it because it is what it is. And I think what's changed, particularly in the UK, is a lot of things have changed around the more responsible roles, the more senior roles in particular. You know, when I thought being a ward sister, as it was called then, was almost the best job in the world. And I think it's a very difficult job to do now, actually, really difficult. And with far fewer staff than we had, I believe, in the day than when I was doing it. I don't think I'm looking through it with rose-tinted specs. Some of it will be, of course, but you know, there are differences.
And I think, I mean, Lisa and I was like pioneers in the field. You know, I've always been the youngest and the first. I started my PhD career when I was 26, which was extremely unusual. I was the youngest nurse at that time defending theses in Sweden. And Lisa has been a pioneer as long as I know knew her. So I think we sort of have that driving force, you know, because we were pioneers and we felt a responsibility in that role to be role models and to invest, show younger nurses that if you want to play, you pay. You sort of need to invest in order to also be able to experience all the extraordinary things that happen within transplantation and donation. So probably there are few pioneers now. I mean, we are getting older, and perhaps things are not that exciting anymore.
I think every era has its excitement, though. So, I mean, you know, now I wish when I hear about all the new technologies and possibility of, you know, assessment and recovery centers, I think, well, I wish I was working for another 10 years. You know, and I won't be working in 10 years' time, I doubt. But and the things that are happening with living donation in the UK at the moment, I find them very exciting. So I think every generation has its thing that it won't yet have seen. I mean, when I qualified, living donation wasn't a huge thing within adult transplantation for kidney at all. It was happening. But I mean, the thought of having a consultant nurse position in living donation at that time would have been unthinkable because they'd say, well, what would that person do? But that job happened because it evolved. And I think every generation will have that. But I absolutely take Anna's point. I think we were particularly lucky that we had that opportunity, as I say, to grow up with what we were doing, you know, to actually be at the forefront of something because it was just happening with you, alongside you. And I think if you can find that thing that you can is your hook. You talked about getting hooked, Anna, and other Anna. And I think it is that hook, isn't it? It's something that hooks us in. What hooks your interest? I couldn't interpret an HLA type truly when I got involved in living donation. But I soon learned and realized how fascinating the whole world could be, really.
Yeah, it's if you're putting the ad out on a side of a box, you could always say job satisfaction guaranteed, isn't it?
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, I just think, you know, I pinch myself sometimes and think, how lucky was I to be a nurse in this specialty at the time that I was.
Yeah, I mean, no field is easy, isn't it? You have your bad days and good days, but you know, as I said, job satisfaction is guaranteed, and we're you know, we're pretty lucky to be in this field. And also, I guess the other thing to mention is that there is a sort of a wide variety of things you could do as a transplant nurse, isn't it? So you've got specialist nurses in organ donation now, you've got living donor coordinators, you've got deceased donor coordinators, you could be a nurse in outpatients and on the acute transplant side. There's things like robotic transplants, enhanced recovery in transplantation. You could be the lead for enhanced recovery in transplantation now. So it's all those things that perhaps one person did 20 years ago is now more specialized, but you know, much more interesting. And you really have the option of choosing, I suppose, which branch of the transplant side you go to. As well,
and I think that's right, Dylan. I think there are lots of opportunities, and I think it's just being a being prepared to say yes rather than no. And I mean, I don't mean to make it simplistic, but it is those things that you think, oh, I'm not really sure about that, but actually it sounds interesting, or it might be for me, is to say yes to the opportunity, and something else will come from it. I think has been my experience, and the other thing I would say is that I've, and again, I recognize this isn't everyone's experience, but what I've always enjoyed is not only the support of my multi-professional colleagues, so surgeons, physicians, the wider team, but also my senior nursing colleagues. And I think that can sometimes be a challenge, actually, for nurses. I'm going to be honest about that, because I think there are people who have worked to different strengths, and there are people who are fabulous managers, and there are people who are very good leaders. And I think those two, sometimes if you fall outside the traditional operational framework within an institution or an organization, and you're doing something a bit different, and you're in an influencing role, it might be less visible actually in many ways in the organization. But actually, it's really important that we nurture those qualities in people, as well as the operational management skills, that we nurture leadership and the ability to influence people and work across professional boundaries, because that is transplantation. It's a team sport.
Yeah, and I totally agree with Lisa, and I think that's been the characteristic of my career, that I've also always said yes instead of no. But when you are sort of going out of the, you know, the regular career path for nurses, it's quite difficult. And I think that's a challenge within nursing more than for surgeons or physicians, where it is more expected that you may sort of make a research career, for example. And to me, I want to be honest that since I've always been the youngest and the first, it has been a quite lonely journey to pursue this academic career. And I'm the only professor in transplant care in Europe, which of course offers great opportunities, but also I have sort of learned to adapt to the fact that it is a lonely path, and if I should provide any advice to younger nurses who wants to pursue an academic career, I think it's important to get a network, as soon as possible with transplant nursing researchers in your own country and in Europe. And because we are rather few, and you really need your network. And on the ESOT website, for example, we have listed the prominent nursing researchers in Europe because we want to enable contact and networking. So it's if you are a nurse who are interested in research, you can look at the website and you can see the faces of the nurses in Europe who are doing research, and hopefully you can get inspired and also find the courage to contact some of them.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I mean, that's something I wanted to touch on. And, you know, is there sort of a fear about, or because it's not a well-trodden path for nurses, a fear of going and asking for research projects, or is the infrastructure not there for that in nursing?
I think it's both. I mean, the infrastructure is still not there. I have done a lot of work in Sweden to develop that infrastructure, but you know, it's a hierarchical system, and nursing research is still a little bit underdeveloped, and there are a lot of focus on the medical research. So I think it's and also that nursing managers seldom have the knowledge when it comes to sort of what to do with a nurse who is interested in pursuing a research career. So, you know, the path is not there, which makes it difficult, I think, or challenging. It's not impossible, but it's challenging.
I find that from my experience that you often need a medical or a surgical academic to support the nursing research, or to bring people to the nursing, from nursing into that research field. So, for example, several of the academic nephrologists and surgeons would get nurses in Birmingham involved in research, and then sponsor them to go and present at conferences and so on and so forth. And then, if there's a topic they like, they can register for an MD or PhD. And I think there's an onus, as you said, there's not many Professor Forsbergs around to go and knock on the door. So you've got to look for mentors in the medical field, and it's an onus on us then to support them through that and create more Professor Forsbergs. Anna, how did you find it getting into research?
Another coincidence. I was actually on maternity leave, and I started to get restless, and I wanted to do something sort of part time, and that's when I started to study my master's. And then while I was doing that, I had no plans at all, not even doing my master's, and absolutely not doing my PhD or getting into research. I was very much convinced that I was a clinical nurse for life, but it's absolutely opened doors for me, and it's gotten me a lot more engaged and involved in the care I give as well.
Did you find the funding for that, or is that something that you found difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult. My master's I got no funding for at all. I did it on my half of it. I did on my maternity leave, and the other half I worked half time and took extra shifts. And my PhD, I spent the first year looking for funding, which I finally got. So now it's all good. I think my best advice to nurses would be to try it, and that it doesn't have to be either or. You can do both.
I think that's true, and I think it is about the going for it. I mean, again, I think this is something about the era in which I trained. It certainly wasn't an era of a research culture in the UK. You know, I did a certificate level nursing course, because actually the university based course at that time, certainly not now, but at that time, was not considered to be, you know, if you wanted to be a proper nurse, you did a clinical training, and that's what I did. It then became immensely difficult after that to catch up academically, because when by the time I wanted to do a master's, I was a whole degree out, you know, because actually to get onto a master's program, I then needed to jump through another few hoops, which I was happy to do because I was very much inspired by the master's I wanted to do. And I did that actually before I became the consultant nurse. And there's a certain irony in that because, in fact, consultant nurses were designed to have a large component of research in their job, but it was a little bit like the concept was great, but actually what happened in the UK was that we had individuals trying to be supermen and superwomen because you were trying to be a clinical consultant and an academic and everything all in one. And you had to make a decision. And I was building a living donor program. So actually my time for research was, I didn't have the time in my job plan really to be able to do to lead meaningfully on research and be a full-time clinical consultant. So in fact I opted for the more clinical route at that time, and my research has been much more collaborative and with my medical colleagues and my surgical colleagues. So my pathway has been a little bit different, but I think it was the concept of the consultant nurse was fantastic, and for me was brilliant because I could retain that clinical focus at a senior level. But the research element, I think we all agreed, you really needed protected time, and as Anna has alluded to, a lot of support and understanding from senior management about what it actually took to get nurse-led research off the ground, and the resources you needed for that.
Although you say you've been very clinical, when I looked you up on PubMed, you do have a fair few publications. And so that sort of signifies your involvement in research as in clinical research, isn't it? And there's no reason why nursing staff cannot be involved. And you don't have to go in with the mindset of, oh, I have to get a PhD out of this. There is the clinical research that you can keep doing, and if it so happens that one of the clinical projects has a wider element to it that can lead on to a PhD, that's when you then take the next step from there if you want to. Is as all of you've said, you've got to say yes to even the smallest projects, because that then leads to a publication that then leads to further publications and a PhD perhaps. So you don't have to be labeled as an academic to do research. You can still do a lot of good work from a clinical perspective.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's very true, Dylan. And I think we tend to feel that we're not doing, Anna's such a wonderful example. And I'm thinking of people like Sabina de Geest as well. And they're fabulous role models. And I knew that that wasn't what I was able to do, but it doesn't, I think it's a point very well made. It doesn't preclude you from being involved in research in your area of expertise at all. But no, I totally agree with him. Sorry, Anna.
No, just about role models. I forgot to mention that I ended up sitting next to Anna Forsberg at a local conference during lunch, which was also what inspired me. I mean, we had one lunch, and afterwards, I pretty much had my PhD project on a napkin, and that was
Fantastic.
it. Yeah. So, role models are obviously very important.
That's sort of my modus operandi, you know. A lot of theses have been planned and organized on napkins during lunches with different persons who want to pursue a research career. So
I think my PhD was sort of also hashed out on a train on the back of a napkin with my supervisor for an hour. So that works. That's a well-trodden path. So I wanted to then just move on to talk about education committee involvements, and again something that I think from the nursing's perspective we need to improve on. And perhaps if I bring Lisa in to this conversation to talk about, you started off as a live donor nurse in at Guy's, but I first remember seeing you in a I think an ethics symposium about 10, 12 years ago, and I remember being so amazed by your ability to get everyone together to talk with surgeons and nephrologists and lead on things like that. How do we inspire that? How has that journey been for you?
It's been wonderful for me, and I think one of the things that Anna alluded to earlier, Anna Forsberg alluded to earlier, is I was in a niche market and I had a role a little bit like you. You know, Anna was referring to the fact that she's the only professor in Europe. I was the only consultant in the UK in transplantation for a while, and then in living donation. So that gave me a lot of opportunities, opened a lot of doors for me, because I found myself in meetings just by virtue of the fact that I had those two aspects. I was a consultant nurse, and that was new, and I worked in living donation. So my clinical networks were built very easily and actually without barriers, because I think transplantation is, I would go so far as to say, an area, a specialty where there are fewer barriers between professional groups. I mean, it didn't feel awkward to me to talk to my surgical and my physician colleagues on first name terms, because that was how they addressed me. And we were within a group doing the same sorts of things and so on. So I think I was hugely helped by the acceptance from my colleagues, as I said earlier. They were my network. They were, you know, that was what allowed me to thrive in a way. And the leadership things, I think I have to say that I really enjoy that aspect. That is my one of my raison d'être, and the education and the bringing people together to create something better out of a group of people. I love that. So it's a bit of a passion for me to do that and to see something come out of it that is really worthwhile and then benefits patients and colleagues. So I suppose I built on that. I mean, when I first came into the, when I first joined the British Transplantation Society, I became the co-chair of the Living Donor Forum. And I remember being asked if I would mind co-chairing that with a surgeon, because that may have a better profile. And I said no. And I suppose I've never been too proud to realize that you do have to make those accommodations, and that actually at certain times it might be appropriate to do that. It doesn't diminish your role in any way, but it just says there's an acceptance here that you might achieve more by saying that's, you know, by compromising. So that was my first experience. And then I got involved actually in ESOT, and then the bringing together of ETCO under the ESOT umbrella in that sort of early, well, I suppose we were around 2010 time. And then I just sort of stayed connected with the BTS in various ways. I had a passion for standards and guidelines, particularly in my area of work and expertise. And there was nothing like trying to write a guideline document for making sure that you were up to date and the latest research and so on, and working with your colleagues again. So for me, I think it's been very organic, but it's an enjoyment of working in a particular way, I think, that has probably motivated me to do that. And I mean, the absolute pinnacle of my career, and will always be, was being the president of the BTS, you know, the British Transplantation Society, because there is nothing quite like being nominated and elected by your peers. And then, of course, I had that anxiety of, now I'm here, will I do justice for everybody to that role? And of course, I never anticipated it would be over quite the period that it was, which was, as you pointed out earlier, the pandemic and so on. So, which in fact tested me in ways I couldn't have imagined, but it was very much working as a team within the BTS, you know, the executive and council. I was very well supported, and I really felt that the membership were behind everything we did. And there was such good feedback at the congresses and so on, that you felt as if you were doing the best you could for people, and they appreciated it. And there was a lovely warm feeling. And I left Edinburgh in March feeling that warmth from people. And that was all I really, really wanted, was to know that I'd done a good job for them. It's part of my personality. I like to work that way, I suppose. And it sort of fed into, it was nicely fueled by the opportunities that I had presented to me.
Yeah, and I think the consensus is you've done an amazing job. So that goes without saying. And it's really interesting what you said about compromise, and that little anecdote you gave, and your interactions and how you compromise and build on it, rather than expecting things to happen really quickly. Sometimes you just got to give it time, isn't it? And say yes at the appropriate times, and then compromise at the appropriate times, and just be available. You know, again, it's all about coming to conferences, talking to people, and you suddenly become first name basis with people, and they suddenly invite you onto committees. you say yes, and the ball just keeps rolling from there.
Yes, and the point I wanted to get to was that I was involved in things because people thought that I was the right person to be involved, rather than I had a particular professional background, or I represent a particular group. Of course, I was representing a particular group, but it's that is the where you've got the really strong positive relationships, I think, is where you are there because of what you bring to the table. And it's that respecting, as you say, the things, that you go through different periods, and I think it's very important for any professional group, but particularly I've found in nursing that you've needed to just know at which point that you say, this is a boundary that I think this is a door to push, and this is one that maybe we can just work through in a different way, or ultimately we'll walk through it. And I think knowing that is really critical to how you build those relationships and move forward with things.
I think you have a strong point here when you say that you have something. I mean, people think that you are the right person and you bring something to the table. And when that happens, it's important that you say yes, because everything within transplantation is very much organized around the medical issues, organ preservation, machine perfusion, surgical technique, immunosuppressive medication, and so forth. So when people realize that you as a nurse actually can contribute with specific knowledge, a specific perspective on the patient, like person-centered care, for example, that I represent, you need to be there. You need to say yes, and you need to be there, and you need to deliver, because you can have a huge impact as a nurse when you are invited to the table, if you take that opportunity and deliver. Yeah, I wanted to add that to Lisa's.
Anna, you've got anything more to add from that perspective? And you've been doing some work with the education committee as well.
I mean, I still feel like a beginner and a newbie. I was invited to join the education committee board, which was an absolute honor, but I had only ever attended one conference myself. The majority of my colleagues are not members of ESOT, and I think a few of them, new nurses, probably don't even know about ESOT. And so I've really been thinking a lot since I myself have gotten involved, like how can we sort of spread the word? How can we get them more involved? Because a lot of nurses, they don't think that they'll ever be able to attend a conference without actually having a contribution to the conference, for example. They don't even think that there's no point in even trying, because they won't be able to go. It's a shame, because the
That's true,
majority of
isn't
nurses are not in research,
it? I
but the
think.
majority of nurses want to learn, and they want to be a part and listen and gain knowledge and become better within the field.
I think it is a challenge, Anna. And if I can cast my mind back to the very, very first British Transplantation Society meeting I went to, which and I was probably many years ahead of where you are now, actually, by the time I went to that meeting. And I remember standing in the door of a room full of people thinking, I know nobody in this room, and I don't know how to get across this room. And then spotted somebody I knew in the distance. And at that time, there wasn't a nurse on the council at all. I was elected onto the council, and then it was in the time of John Forsyth, when he was the president of the British Transplantation Society, and then he subsequently became president of ESOT. But at that time, he then wanted to have a look at a review of the constituents parts of the British Transplantation Society. And we did a survey of nurses. And what we found from that is that actually the BTS positions itself in a certain place for nursing. I mean, that was at that time. It may be different now, but actually, you're looking at nurses who are committed to organ donation and transplantation, who have an interest in the BTS. So they may not be the newly qualified nurse, who may go to different kinds of meetings to get different kinds of experiences. And so I suppose part of it was helpful for me at that stage, which is perhaps the stage you're at now, is thinking about, okay, where's our audience? Where do we need to pitch to first? Because it may grow from that point, but actually, how can we get them involved? And then even if they're not active researchers, that they submit a good idea that they've been working on, because they may get a poster in that meeting, or they may get, you know, just something that allows them to contribute, even if they're not doing a master's or a PhD or an empirical piece of research. It's a beginning, and they buddy up with others too who are doing that to give them the confidence to do that. We haven't got it sorted completely over here at all, but I do feel, and I like to think, that people through work that actually that my colleagues in the chapter of nurses in the BTS have done, particularly in recent years, they've begun to inspire that kind of following and that kind of confidence for nurses, allied health professionals, to think, actually, I can submit a paper that may get an oral presentation in the Six of the Best or whatever. It takes a while, but it's certainly more than possible. And I think that buddying, that mentoring, is something that you can offer, because you've already talked about it today.
Yeah, so well done for all of you for that culture change over the years, and for continuing to do that culture change. A lot of positives there. So I want to end this podcast by talking about a little bit about your personal work-life balance and how you keep going despite this kind of difficult work that we do. Perhaps if I start with Anna, what sort of hobbies and interests outside of work do you do? Anna Brandmark.
Oh God, I really wish I had something exciting to say about this, but I'm very, very mainstream in terms of hobbies and like exercise, cook,
sounds
meet
like
friends and family.
At home.
Yeah, normal. Normal stuff.
Professor Forsberg?
Well, I'm not actually a role model at all when it comes to work-life balances. My research is sort of, you know, it's a lifestyle. I think that most of the persons knowing me think that I work too much. But I actually go to the gym 5 times a week. So that's sort of my hobby these days.
Wow, that's amazing in itself.
I realized that it's important to be strong, not only strong-minded, but also have a strong body, and because that's give me sort of endurance also when it comes to work and other things. So yeah. I'm a gym person at the moment.
And Lisa?
Well, I'm just hoping that none of my friends and family listen to this podcast, because they're very much like Anna. I can relate completely. They would say, you know, it is a lifestyle choice. So I do work hard, because I love what I do. But it doesn't feel like hard work. Yeah, I do it because I want to. But that's not really the answer you're looking for, Dylan. I do have actually quite a lot of interests outside. It's just finding the time to squeeze them in. So I have family that extends in lots of directions, and they're a real joy to me, particularly the new additions to the family that keep coming, and I love that, and I love spending time with them. I have absolutely fantastic friendship group who have stood by me through thick and thin all these years, so I'm very blessed. I love to be outside, and I you know, gardening and anything outdoors. I don't go to the gym 5 times a week. That's made me feel very inadequate, Anna. But I do try and do a bit of that, because actually exercise and cooking I find incredible. And cooking was something I discovered in COVID was something you could do. And, you know, because actually at the end of the day, you could kind of put a line in the sand and you could cook, and it was creative. So I enjoy being creative. I enjoy sewing, gardening, doing all those sorts of things. I dream of having time to do all the things I want to do other than my job. And one of these days I will make that happen. But for the moment, that's the balance, which may not sound like much of a balance.
Thanks, Lisa. I didn't realize that was going to be the hardest question that I'm going to ask
you.
So you guys always you guys are in your flow and in your element for the last. So we've been talking for 1 hour and 3 minutes. Can you imagine that? It's meant to be a short, sharp podcast.
It was really lovely to speak to Anna in this way. Both Annas, actually, in this way. And Anna B has taken me back to thinking about, actually, though, you know, listening to you makes me realize that was in the same way I felt inspired. So in 20 years time, we'll be listening to you doing a podcast, I'm quite sure of that.
Well, thank you so much, all of you, for taking the time to do this and providing that inspiration for hopefully a new generation of nurses. I hope you enjoyed your time on the podcast, and we look forward to being involved with you and your work with YPT in the future. So thank you again, and thank you everyone for listening to the podcast. As I say, please feel free to go and listen to the other podcasts and spread the word about these. The podcasts are available on Transplant Live and through the ESOT website, as well as on Spotify. Thank you all. Thank you, Anna Brandmark, Professor Forsberg, Lisa Bernapp, again for joining us.